For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, friends. You are back and listening to Behind the Knife. I am Michael Vu, and you know what? It's been a little bit of time here since we've done a transplant episode. So we all got together and said, heck, let's talk about transplant this week. We're going deep into the nitty and gritty of surgical technique today, people. I mean, for this episode, I want you to imagine strapping on a GoPro to an experienced transplant surgeon's head and seeing each knife stroke, each retraction maneuver, each stitch placed in the execution of a successful kidney transplant. Of course, you'll in fact be listening to the technical steps eloquently described to you verbally by our guests, but I'm not kidding about the GoPro thing either. If you're listening to this as a podcast, you'll find that it's actually a video podcast, and we'll also be posting the video to our YouTube channel where you may in fact be watching this. So the operative video, we hope will closely follow what you are listening to. Okay, let me introduce our guest today. First and foremost, we've got Dr. Leanne Daggerford. She's a transplant surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital and assistant professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School. Accompanying her are her two fellows, Dr. Anushi Shaw, one of the first-year transplant fellows, and Dr. Ashley Aaron, one of the second-year fellows. Big thanks to the three of you guys for coming onto the show today. I know that the transplant surgery lifestyle is not always amenable to these kinds of scheduled events, so it means a huge, it's a huge deal for us to get you guys on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you don't mind, Dr. Daggerford, Dr. Shaw, Dr. Aaron, if our audience gets to know a little bit more about you before we take that deep dive into surgery. Why don't you tell us where you grew up briefly and how you found your way into transplant surgery?
Great. I grew up in Kentucky and did some school outside of Chicago and then spent quite a bit of time in Nashville, Tennessee, doing medical school and residency before I did my fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis. And then I became a Northerner in some sense and moved up here to New England. I became interested in transplant because of a living donor kidney transplant when I was a second year resident rotating on the transplant surgery service. There's nothing quite like it to see a kidney go from gray to pink and make urine on the table.
So I grew up in New York, went to medical school in the Caribbean at St. Matthew's in Cayman Islands, and then I did residency in Phoenix at ValueWise Medical Center, formerly known as Maricopa Medical Center, and then came out here for fellowship. I really got into transplant when I was doing mostly my vascular rotation first and really just loved doing anastomoses and the maximally invasive side of the world. And endovascular wasn't my thing, so I pursued transplant after I got exposed to it in my transplant rotations.
Awesome, awesome. And Dr. Aaron?
I grew up in the Midwest mostly and did medical school and undergrad at the University of Minnesota, which was always this huge transplant epicenter. And that's where I became interested in transplant. The fellows were great about taking us out as medical students and taking us out on donor runs and taking us into the OR. I held a Castro when I was a third year medical student, which was very daunting, but all of it was so much fun. I had such good mentoring and I really loved the change in life for the patients. And that's how I became interested in transplant. And then I came out to the East Coast to train. I trained at Brigham for general surgery and for my ICU fellowship, and then came just down the street to MGH for my transplant fellowship.
Very cool. Well, thank you to you three for sharing your backgrounds. So let's hop straight into it with kind of a clinical vignette. So, you know, this is a pretty classic kind of case, but suppose that you have a 57-year-old female with obesity, hypertension, diabetes, and end-stage kidney disease. She's undergoing hemodialysis through her AV fistula, and she presents for a deceased donor kidney transplant. What are the first things you're thinking about when she comes in and you hear that there's a kidney available that are just going to be, you know, possible hard stops to this whole endeavor from the get-go?
Yeah, so I'll start. I mean, I just have to put out a disclaimer. There's a lot of different ways to do a kidney transplant, and every center has a lot of different practices and training methods. And even within a center, all of the surgeons have different methods. So these are going to be the basic principles that are universal, like tension-free anastomosis, hemostasis, positioning, placement. Some of it can vary, but we'll kind of go through what we're most familiar with. And to go back and answer your question about heart stops when we're first presented with a patient, you know, we want to make sure that they don't have any kind of active infection, or check their workup and make sure they don't have any cancers that are ongoing or untreated, and then overlook their cardiac status, any coronary artery disease that would preclude them from the surgery. And then also if they are on dialysis, when they had dialysis last, and if their electrolytes are not amenable to anesthesia, then we kind of have to take a look and reassess.
Okay. Let's say that your patient is going to be a good candidate for your deceased donor kidney transplant, because what we do want to get into is drill into the surgical principles and the technique. You're in the OR. There are so many, you know, the kidney transplant is just a rich network of decision-making branch points. Starting from when you get the donor kidney on your back table, what are the kinds of things that you are thinking about when you're, you know, about to start this transplant? You're looking at this kidney and this patient on the table.
Sure. One of the first things I think is how the kidney looks, the size, what side it came from, right side, left side, and kind of orient yourself around the kidney. Some come with a lot of fat on them, some with very little. So it's kind of important to make sure you get your landmarks straight. And then the location and the number of the arteries, veins, and identify the ureter.
So for kind of the medical students or some of the younger residents out there who might not be aware, what is the normal anatomic arrangement of how many arteries, veins, ureters the kidney should have, and what are some common aberrant variations that you're seeing on the back table?
So normal, you know, anterior to posterior vein artery, we always learn vein artery nerves here, it's vein artery ureter. And obviously you want single of each, but there's always variations. Most commonly I have seen like multiple arteries, but I'll maybe have Dr. Aaron or Dr. Daggerford chime in here to see if they've seen more commonly other things.
I've certainly seen multiple veins. And I've actually seen a couple double ureters, both in recovering the kidneys and then once having to implant them. So we certainly can have a lot of different types.
As long as the length is good on the arteries, almost all of them can be reconstructed. So rarely do we encounter a problem where even multiple ureters, you just do two anastomoses to the bladder. And for the artery, you have a choice as to if you're gonna sew in two separate anastomoses or potentially put them together into a fish mouth, where you actually put the two ends of the artery together to make one orifice before you sew it in to the recipient. So thankfully, none of these variances that we're describing would stop us from using the kidney for transplant.
So besides variation in the number of tubes coming out of the kidney, what about the kidney itself? What do you do when you find a mass on the kidney?
So you kind of want to evaluate it to see if it's a simple cyst versus something like a subcapsular hematoma or something more alarming like a malignant mass, and in which case we would try to biopsy it. If it's a simple cyst or a hematoma, we kind of leave it alone and see how it reperfuses and if there is an issue. But other than that, I think that just to make sure that the capsule is intact and evaluate the biopsy site. Sometimes the site is big and you want to make sure to plug it with a piece of fat or something so you don't have a lot of bleeding. But other than that, I don't think there's anything particular like I look for when I look at a kidney itself.
So in regards to the patient then, let's talk about what choice of site that you're placing the kidney in. First of all, when do you choose the left versus the right groin?
So the right side is easier to expose and do the anastomosis. So most commonly we go to the right side. Obviously, if they've had a prior transplant and this is a redo, and they have, the right side has been used, then we go to the left side, which is also fine to do. Rarely we go intra-abdominal if both sides have been used for transplant or the vessels that we would transplant to have a lot of calcifications or are not amenable to clamping, which we would evaluate preoperatively from a scan.
How about those patients who have a peritoneal dialysis catheter in place? How does that change your approach and your thinking?
So in our most common practice for patients that have a PD catheter, we still tend to go to the right side, but we can also use the left side. It wouldn't change the approach. We do take out the PD catheters at the end of our procedure, and that might not be something that's done universally, but at our center, we take them out, and then if they need dialysis after, we would do hemodialysis.
What's the reasoning for doing hemodialysis afterwards instead of peritoneal dialysis if the patient already has the catheter in place?
Yeah, so the best way I understand it, and Dr. Dyfer, you might have to correct me, or Dr. Aaron, is that we, in case there is any violation of the peritoneum or anything, we just don't want that fluid getting close to the graft or any kind of spillage into the retroperitoneum from it. So I think it's easier to just take that out and have them go through hemodialysis for a short period of time if they need it.
Okay.
Sometimes the peritoneal dialysis isn't felt to be as efficient for achieving the clearance that's needed after a transplant as hemodialysis is. Now, there are some centers that use it and do it, especially in a pediatric world. Sometimes they're more willing to try the peritoneal dialysis, but in a lot of situations, it's just felt to not adequately clear the electrolytes. And so a lot of places opt for hemo in that situation.
It's very sensible to me. So I want to get straight into kind of the steps of the procedure, and I'll let you guys go from there, starting with whomever, and you guys can bounce back and forth as comfortable. Why don't you just start from patient prep, patient positioning, and tell us how you do this this amazing procedure. And keeping in mind that, number one, it is challenging to visualize this kind of thing purely verbally. Now, we will have the video available, but some people might be listening to this in their car. So, try to be as precise as possible. And a lot of our listeners are new in their medical education. So giving a lot of broad context over the anatomy and what exactly, you're doing from a technique perspective would be super helpful. Why don't you take it away?
All right, so I'll start with the prepping and positioning the patient. We usually have them supine on the operating room table. Our perioperative meds include skin coverage, antibiotics. We usually use ANSEF. And induction includes either thymoglobulin or Simulect, depending on the patient. Some centers also use Campath. And then we also give these patients Solumedrol at induction. In addition to that, for prepping, all these patients get a Foley catheter, and then we hook them up to a blue-colored antibiotic solution in a saline bag, and that comes into play later on when we're doing the bladder anastomosis. We normally tuck the arm that the kidney transplant is going, the side that it's going to be on. So if it's the right side that we're transplanting, we would tuck the right arm just for retractor purposes. And then after the prep, we'd place Ioban on the surgical field.
So I'm going to just insert here what she's talking about when she's talking about induction medication. So the miracle of kidney transplant really only happens because we're able to keep the recipient body from rejecting the donor organ. And the original kidney transplant, which happened in Boston, so we have to give a plug, happened between twins. But since then, we've developed all of these mechanisms to try and suppress the immune system so that it doesn't reject the kidney coming from a non-self donor, so from the donor. And so to do that, at the time of the transplant, we give what's called induction immunosuppression. And it's a pretty big, heavy hammer of medications that push down on the immune system. And those are the ones that she was describing. So solumedrol is a steroid that's very, we give a high dose IV steroid. And then we give thymoglobulin and or Simulect. And then she also mentioned Campath. So those are just different mechanisms of medications to suppress the immune system. And those are what we call induction because they're given at the start, at the beginning of the transplant to induce the immunosuppression. And then after the transplant, these patients all stay on maintenance immunosuppression. So medication that they take every day for the rest of their lives to keep them from rejecting the transplanted organ.
And that induction regimen, that's the first time that the recipient is going to be seeing immunosuppression, kind of the, you know.
Yes. Some people give an oral medication on the way to the operating room, but really it doesn't happen until, you know, really until they're in the operating room.
And I'd like to just make sure we clarify that blue colored antibiotic solution as well. So that is going to be going into the Foley, and it's an antibiotic solution that fills up the bladder, right? For eventually you'll be violating the bladder in order to sew in that ureter. Is that right?
Yep. The solution is just really an aid to the surgeons to try and make sure that the bladder is easily identifiable. The other fluid-filled sac in the abdomen is the peritoneum. We talked about peritoneal dialysis, and it would be a pretty major whoops to mistake one fluid-filled sac for the other and sew the ureter to the peritoneum instead of to the bladder. And so to help us, because we're, you know, we're not perfect by any means, to help us identify that, we use blue solution into the bladder through the Foley that gives us a nice reassurance that we're sewing the urine to the right fluid-filled sac.
Well, that is a simple and clever way to make sure you're in the right spot.
Awesome, awesome. Well, let's get to the incision then, the good stuff.
So once we're prepped and draped for the incision part, we like to go make a curvilinear incision to about 2 finger breadths from medial to the ASIS and 1 finger breadth above the pubic bone. And we make the skin incision with a knife and then take the abdominal wall layers with electrocautery and some blunt dissection. So just to go over the skin, the abdominal wall layers, you have the skin and the subcutaneous fat. After that, you have Scarpa's fascia. And then you run into the external oblique, aponeurosis, and muscle. We go through that, and you have the internal oblique, and then the transversalis. And the peritoneum is right under the transversalis. We usually use most of our blunt dissection here as well so that we don't violate the peritoneum, enter the intra-abdominal cavity. And we enter laterally to the anterior rectus sheath and sweep the peritoneum medially and superiorly. And the native ureter is swept up with the peritoneum. So it'll be out of the area where we would identify the vessels and dissect this plane. And we dissect this plane straight down to the retroperitoneum until we reach the psoas muscle. And when we, if the plane is correct, it should be avascular, but sometimes you have a lot of collaterals in between the muscle and the peritoneum and the retroperitoneum fat pad that there is some bleeding. But we enter this space all the way down to the psoas, sweep up the peritoneum medially and superiorly, and then identify the iliac vessels.
Sometimes with our blunt dissection, some ways to make it easier is we'll just put a bunch of lap pads in there. It kind of does a dissection for us, especially if you're in that correct plane and it's completely avascular, like 3, 4, 5 lap pads, you'll usually have the size of a kidney. And then after that, it's really just identifying, controlling the iliac vessels.
So once we have created this space, we usually put on our retractors to kind of help us look at the vessels and create our field where we're going to be doing the anastomosis. There are some structures you run into. So if it's a female patient, you'll run into a round ligament, which we usually ligate. If it's a male patient, we'll encircle the cord structures and with a vessel loop and kind of get them out of the way under the retractors. And then in both males and females, we'll ligate the epigastrix to help us with exposure.
Sometimes, like we talked about before, if you know you already have some strange vasculature or multiple arteries, sometimes you can leave epigastrix as a point to anastomose arteries, but it's kind of a rarity. But that might be one case where you wouldn't necessarily want to take them ahead of time, but that you would probably know that ahead of time.
So you might do an anastomosis to the epigastrix, is that what you're saying?
It's been done, especially with lower pole vessels, since that's very important. If there's any sort of injury to that, the lower pole supply is really your ureter, and you wouldn't want to accidentally remove that vascular supply. It can be done, it can be a nice little trick, but you would know that ahead of time from looking at your kidney, back tabling it, and knowing what vessels you have.
And then the inferior edge of our dissection is really until you feel the pubic bone and feel for the Foley balloon. And that's when you kind of know you can stop there. And once you blow up the or fill up the bladder, you'll be able to identify it there. So once we've placed our retractors, we begin with our external iliac artery dissection and mobilize it circumferentially. And usually the external iliac doesn't have any branches, so you can get around the artery with the Penrose and then just take down the attachments from it with Bovie. Some people like to suture ligate these attachments as there may be some lymphatics here as well. We do this both superiorly and inferiorly along the length of the artery so that we're able to medialize it if necessary.
Some of the things you always look out for, there's usually a vein running across the artery very distally. You wanna make sure and control that. It's gonna be a difficult place to control if you accidentally come across it and don't have good control. But other than that, getting good length on both of those vessels, both the artery and vein, really helps you once you have your kidney in place and are getting everything positioned, so you don't have any kinking and torquing for your anastomoses.
Yeah, sometimes we'll use a Satinsky clamp just to kind of see how our clamping would be and if there's enough mobilization or length in both vessels as we're trying to get around them and dissect them superiorly and inferiorly, just to make sure that the exposure is good, because that is definitely the key in this operation in the start. And I will say, like, if patients have had prior appendectomy or maybe had a perforated appendix, this plane and this dissection can sometimes be very difficult, and sometimes the vein is hard to peel off and mobilize from the peritoneum as well. Usually the dissection around the vein, you can do bluntly with like even a suction and to just try and get around it. But if they've had prior operations in this area or inflammatory reactions, this can be a little difficult.
Is that a reason you may choose to go on the left side from the get-go? Or do you usually give it a shot on the right and see what you come up against?
In my experience, we usually give it a shot. Have you guys steered away?
No, I mean, the right can just be so much easier as far as how superficial the vessels are compared to the left, especially if you have a deep patient or obese patient. But I would want to give it a shot unless I were very concerned.
How many centimeters would you say you're mobilizing of both those vessels on average, just to give our viewers an idea of how much is needed for a good anastomosis?
I would say it really depends on how everything looks. You've looked at your kidney. If you have a living donor kidney, you're gonna have a shorter artery and vein on that kidney, so you might want more mobilization. If you have very long artery and vein on a deceased donor kidney, you might not need as much. I have the preference of basically mobilizing almost the entire external, because I want a lot of leeway. I'm sure there are people that don't like to do that. I think it's really independent of whoever's doing the operation.
So the kidney usually comes on ice. Some people like to put a lap pad around the kidney just to keep keep it cold while we're doing the anastomosis. Some don't, but once the vessels are exposed and there's good hemostasis, we're usually ready for the anastomosis.
Why don't you take us through it? Which one are you starting with first?
So we usually start with the vein first. We'll place the Sutinsky clamp around the extra-iliac vein, make a venotomy with the size of our donor vein, and then use heparin-infused saline, just to flush out the vein and make sure that it's clear. It kind of helps us clear out any leftover blood in the vein and also see if there's any kind of collaterals that are still feeding that vein if we need to reposition our clamping. And then after that, we start with the anastomosis, usually with a 5-0 or a 6-0 double arm proline. We set both corners and tie them down, and then sew the lateral side first and then the medial. Once the vein is done circumferentially, we'll clamp the renal vein with we usually used a Garbodi, which is just a shorter version of the Sutinsky clamp. There's different variations of this, and kind of release the extra-iliac to check the anastomosis, but not reperfuse the kidney entirely. And then we'll leave the renal vein clamp while we sew the artery.
Okay.
So just to help visualize, this is an end-to-side anastomosis.
Yeah, and so how exactly are you clamping with the Sutinsky for our listeners? What does it look like, the vessel after it's been clamped? And
Go ahead.
You might be better able to explain this, how it looks.
So first off, just for what a Sutinsky looks like, basically I kind of think of the Sutinsky almost looking like a little dipper. It's basically a square bottom and then a handle that comes off one side. And when you clamp the external vein, you're going to have the clamp coming off distally, so towards the feet, and then the little tip, the little part of the square, will go off towards the head. And that way the vein is between these two points, and that bottom connecting point of the square is underneath the vein. That way you have both distal and proximal control with one clamp. And then when you take that off, after you've made your anastomosis, you put on a smaller clamp on the renal vein, and that way you don't get that warm blood shooting up back towards the kidney. Some people don't use a Sutinsky. Some people use two independent clamps and don't even take it off at that point. It's just a style preference.
Okay.
If that helps.
It does. Thank you.
I will say that some people medialize the artery before they sew in the vein. And some people only do that depending on if they're sewing in a right kidney or left kidney, but other places routinely medialize the artery. So that just means it's a little bit easier to sew the artery anastomosis after the vein has been sewn, because it's kind of medialized to the other side of the vein, whereas usually it would be more lateral.
And where's the donor kidney sitting while you're doing all this?
Who's the surgeon? So sometimes some people make a kidney sock. Some people put the kidney in a little sling that's made of a lap. Some people put the kidney down in the abdomen and put ice packs by the kidney. Whatever we're doing, we're trying to sew quickly to minimize our warm ischemic time, meaning while the kidney's, not fully on ice and not reperfused. And we're trying to...
Talking about money is hard. People all over the world were taught never to talk about money, politics, sex, or religion in polite company. But on this show, my goal is to remove money from that list. And so I'm excited to bring you 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning from Blind Nil Audio and executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines. Follow and listen to 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning with me, Carl Richards, wherever you get your podcasts.